ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A young scientist flees Nazi Germany and ends up building the atomic bomb for Britain and America. But behind the lab coat, he's a Soviet spy. Klaus Fuchs, the physicist who decided the fate of the world and gave the West's greatest secrets to the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app or look for it on the ABC Rewind podcast feed.
And it's time for another science show, but not just another. You see, despite being after Christmas, we shall still have lots of reindeer. But most of all, we now have a fresh guide for you in this scientific quest. Her name is Belinda Smith, and she's with me now. Welcome, Belle.
Thanks, Robin. It's an honour and a thrill to be sharing the Science Show presenter seat with you. I'm coming from Melbourne on Wurundjeri country.
Splendid. So have you forsaken your lab notes?
Look, forsaken's a pretty strong word. I prefer to think I've reared and nurtured lab notes to the point where it can be set free into the very capable hands of ABC science editor Jonathan Webb.
He actually once worked in a lab in Oxford. Mm. Did you also work in a lab?
I did, not at Oxford, but it was neuroscience. So like you, I studied science at university. But there was a small problem with me. It turns out I'm not actually very good at doing science.
Oh.
Rather than concentrating on my own research question, I was far more interested in running down other interesting rabbit holes. So I switched to science journalism, where I can run down all the interesting rabbit holes I like.
Indeed. What about Dimboola? Hmm. Is that in northern Queensland where you come from?
No, I'm from Dimboola in Western Victoria. So it's famous for the play and some Sidney Nolan paintings, but more recently producing excellent science journalists.
And what kind of ologist are you? Are you inclined as an anthropologist, perhaps?
Oh, look, Robin, I don't like to limit myself to one ology. I'm ology curious, you might say. But I do think that there's an innate desire to learn about where we came from as a species and what and who we encountered along the way.
The reason I ask is that on Tuesday last on ABC television, a show, in fact a series called Human, talked about the key role this country played in our evolution. We sailed for the first time as humans across the seas from what is now Indonesia to a place later to be called Australia. And on the screen it said 45,000 years ago, but the accepted date scientifically is 65,000. What's going on?
Yes, this is a particularly thorny patch of science we've waded into, Robin. So that 65,000-year figure comes from an iconic site called Majabebe. It's about 300 kilometres east of Darwin, near Kakadu, in Mirar country. In 2017, archaeologists reported finding thousands of artefacts over the years, such as spear tips, ochre crayons, grinding stone and axe, the oldest of which were dated to around 65,000 years old, give or take 5,000 years. But the 45,000-year figure that was displayed in that second episode of the series Human, they don't say where they got that number from, but I suspect it came from genetic evidence. So that's tracing history through DNA. Recently, there's been some gene studies which point to the first human arrival to Australia happening around 60,000 years ago. So getting older and closer to that 65,000 archaeological date or archaeological timestamp. But these studies, these gene studies, rely on a lot of assumptions. So it's still a pretty controversial area.
Well, I hope you'll have something on this in the Science Show next week.
Oh, you know it.
Now in today's program, we go actually to Lapland, to Sweden, within the Arctic Circle. That's where in Kiruna, they have one of the world's really gigantic mines, so big that the town is sinking. I've in fact reported on this before, but now it's more serious than ever. Even vast buildings, such as Sweden's favourite church, are having to be moved on trucks. What do you think?
When you first told me about this story, my brain immediately went to, how the devil do you move an entire church, a wooden one, no less? And not just the building itself, but almost the whole kit and caboodle. So that includes the pipe organ that sits inside and it's hundreds of pipes. It's quite the feat of engineering.
And the whole point about this story in Kiruna is it's instructive for other regions globally, isn't it?
It could well be, assuming that's even possible in other areas. So in Kiruna, they had to widen the roads and demolish an aqueduct that was in the way just to let the church trundle along to its new home, which is incredible in itself.
Yes, the story is incredible. Here is Anne Holmes, who lives in Sweden, but used to live here in Australia, reporting from way up in the Arctic Circle.
The vast wilderness far north of the polar circle in Swedish Lapland has an epic beauty. Rolling hills meet the sky with pine and birch trees among sparkling red, green and white mosses and lichens, crucial for the migrating herds of reindeer. Their dry feces are the only sign of animal life, although there are moose, bears and wolverines lurking somewhere out there. The silence is thick. I'm standing in a sudden clearing in the forest, above a small slope of black and grey stones, seemingly of no value. But what I'm actually looking at is said to be the future of Europe, even with strong global implications. Tiny plants of spruce shoot up between the small stones, as if nature is trying to reclaim the land. Nearby, a metal pipe emerges in the lush moss, covered with a red lid. A discreet sign of an Australian presence in the Arctic. There are more pipes in the woods, remains from test drilling by Perth-based mining company Talga, who believe they've struck not gold, but graphite.
Well, I think the main thing is the largest resource in Europe of natural graphite. The concentration is very high. It's around 24%. It's really important for the self-sufficiency of Europe.
Emma Schalin is a manager of Talga's small test factory, 4 hours' drive south in the town of Luleå, near the port on the Baltic Sea. Here, Emma shows me how these small stones from the woods are purified into a fine powder of 99.95% graphite, which is a soft but very stable form of carbon. With an added coating, it goes through a big burner in the factory until it becomes so-called anode material, the key component in lithium batteries. Graphite is traditionally used in many areas, from pencils to lubricants. But today, should fossil fuel be phased out, these stones from the remote forest area called Vittangi are instrumental in making sure that we're all able to charge our electric cars.
Yeah, if you include the car industry, you need around 1 million tons of graphite to satisfy demand in Europe for batteries by 2035. So we've got a long way to go. At the moment, there is no refining capacity to make that sort of quantity at all. There's zero. We certainly have the scale in the resource in Europe, and we certainly have the technology, so we're there to support and provide as much as we can. We're starting with 20,000 tonnes, which is a modest start, and we hope to be up and running in a couple of years.
Another 600 miles south, in Sweden's capital, Stockholm, Talga CEO Martin Phillips elaborates on future developments. The graphite obtained during prospecting in Vittangi is enough to keep the small test factory in Luleå running until the new main factory is finished nearby. Talga is already selling its test product around the world, while at the same time working in a lab to refine the material. At the mine to be in the Vittangi forest, there will also be a concentration plant. But how come Talga, a golden iron ore explorer in Western Australia, has made such an investment in faraway Swedish Lapland?
Our founder in 2011 looked at the lithium-ion battery industry and the development of all of the critical raw materials that are needed to make batteries. So at that time when he saw that coming over the horizon, he set about looking for what he thinks is the best deposit. And in Sweden, you will find in the northern part of Sweden, in Vittangi, the data base of information that Sweden had provided on for public information was this fantastically rich deposit. Well, it was found a long time ago. The Swedish geological group had found the deposit. They had opened up exploration to foreign investment only, I think, in the 80s. People had come through. They started looking for more base metals in those days. The battery industry didn't exist then. We proceeded to drill it and size the whole deposit itself. And what we have now is Europe's largest resource. The purity of it being so high and the size of it in combination is unique.
In 2024, the EU, the European Union, formulated a new law called Critical Raw Materials Act. The aim is to secure minerals essential for the green transition. Secure means we must be independent from China, who totally dominates this global market and for the moment is withholding its export. Talga has now officially been given EU priority with a so-called fast track to utilize our findings of graphite in Sweden. So the serene little clearing in the Vittangi forest is now labeled as of great strategic importance, and Talga has already secured several other deposits in the area.
When we acquired the graphite, what came with it was some other deposits as well. So we acquired also copper, cobalt deposits. We also had been exploring and had surveyed areas, and we've since picked up a lithium project. That deposit looks interesting, but these are all exploration projects.
So in the pipeline could be key elements for not just electric vehicles, but also wind turbines, energy storing systems, and consumer electronics like mobiles, laptops, and materials for the dramatic rearmament of EU's and the Defence Alliance NATO's military capacity in the shadow of Vladimir Putin's Russian aggression. The Luleå factory is the first in Europe to turn graphite into anodes, and a very different type of anodes it is. Today, most graphite is synthetic, 90% produced in China through heating up petroleum coke to 3,000 degrees for several days, a very high energy demanding process that causes severe CO2 pollution. And that means that today's electric cars are actually not all that fossil free. Back to Emma Schelin in Luleå.
At this moment at the facility where we have the pilot plant and the test facility, and our products have qualified and gone through very rigorous processes, and we're really happy with the results. The analysis shows that compared to Chinese synthetic graphite, which is produced with a high energy, CO2 footprint is actually 92% less.
Furthermore, Talga operates on green energy from the majestic rivers running from the mountains in Norway in the west, with lots of hydropower plants.
Graphite is a staple of the lithium ion industry. There's a need to maintain that material, and it adds to the quality of life for people. I think it gives the ability to reduce CO2 emissions. Everyone has, a strong need to look at climate change, and whether you're working in the city or whether you have a need to be in the hills of the Kiruna region and be using skidoos and enjoying life as well, and reindeer herding. So I think we all have a common goal, which is climate is affecting all of us. And I think graphite is a staple of the battery industry, and you need to keep coming up with a supply chain that's going to be very low in CO2 and ensure that you've got the battery industry.
Yet Talga is a small player in the Lapland mining industry. Further west, closer to the mountains, is Kiruna, the town built on top of the world's largest underground iron ore mine, LKAB, that provides 80% of all iron ore for Europe. A giant with 5,000 employees in 12 countries. And now, this state-owned company has stumbled upon something new and immensely valuable. Europe's largest deposit of so-called rare earth metals, exceeding 1 million tons. Graphite is not a rare earth metal. That group is defined as 17 elements absolutely crucial for a green transition. None of these elements are currently mined in Europe, and again, China totally dominates the market. So also this new find has been given EU priority with a fast track, just like Talga. EU estimates that European demand for rare earth metals will be fivefold by 2030. However, for all this intended mining, including Talga, there is a dilemma brought to a head by the Swedish environmentalists who are saying, what shall we choose, a super clean mineral for a better climate or an open pit mine locally affecting both untouched nature, biodiversity and the indigenous people's ancient culture of animal husbandry, the reindeer herding? Talga started exploring for graphite in 2012, but only received its permission by the Swedish government in June 2025, after numerous local appeals against the mine, including 23 environmental assessments and 8 court hearings. Emma Schelin.
It's quite unusual to start a new mine, so we have the opportunity to actually do things right from the start. We have worked from the start very close to the local community, and actually we've done a really good job.
Others disagree, especially the local Sami, Europe's only recognized indigenous people. Today, few belonging to this group live on the traditional reindeer herding, but there are still 51 so-called Sami villages stretching for more than 500 miles over forests and mountains. These are not villages as such, but economic associations with several families keeping their reindeer together in designated areas. Martin Phillips.
I think the key focus has always been how to coexist and how to mine without influencing the reindeer herders, especially during winter. The second thing is the water and how to minimise water going contamination of the river. I think when you go to site, you don't realise how tight and how small we make the mine. I think that's a really important thing, keeping the footprint down. The second thing is we're only doing blasting and mining during the summer. And the idea for us when we looked and workshopped these with our Sami reindeer herding groups was to look at ways where they can access their pastoral areas and feeding areas during key months, and we can do mining in the other months. So that's how we're working.
In Sami tradition, there are not 4 but 8 seasons, all linked with the reindeer life cycle. The main practice is to keep the herds up in the mountains for summer grazing and then in the lowland forests and mires over winter. And Talga, in order to accommodate what they see as the Sami's needs, has agreed not to mine for the 6 winter months.
I think it's a really good thing, and I also think it's the first initiative for this Sweden.
But Nils Johannes Allas, chairman of the Vittangi Sami village, he disagrees. He claims that their herd of up to 7,000 animals will suffer since all other mining activities, like the concentration plant, will also continue operating in the wintertime and thereby disturb the reindeer's natural living conditions.
We have been here in hundreds and hundreds of years, and the reindeers are used to be in this area. It's like a safe zone for them. It's gonna be a lot of noise, and the reindeers are going to spread all over the place. It's going to be a hard work to hold the reindeers in the woods because winter time is like rest period for us and for the reindeers, because they just want to eat and we want to rest. They are going to industries around the year all the time. The explosions, it's going to be traffic and noise. our rangers gonna spread to other families, and it's hard to herd rangers when we don't have control over our rangers. If they spread to other Sami villages.
Nils Johannes Alas disputes that this is a green development.
It's not green for us. It's a black world for us. Our culture gonna disappear from the area.
And Sanna Inga Poruma, the deputy mayor of Kiruna municipality, agrees.
I am generally concerned about the Sami people and their traditional reindeer herding. If we continue this expanse of the mining industry here, we can lose one of Sweden's most important traditions because they have been here so long, hundreds of years, and unfortunately had to experience this over and over again. You can't have a mine and reindeer herding at the same place. You can't. It's not working.
Outside Kiruna town, two other Sami villages are up in arms because of Elke Abi's new intention to mine yet another gigantic body of 500 million tons of unusually rich iron ore, plus proposed excavation of the newfound rare earth metals. The Sami claim that this will block the only passage up to the mountains for the migrating reindeer herds. Maria Dahlgren agrees. She's a journalist at the Sami language program on Swedish public service television, and she has for many years covered the ancient conflict between the Sami and the government.
Their traditional way of rain herding will be totally disrupted because they have to find other ways to, for example, transport reindeers. Their head is like a navigator. They go from the wood area up to the mountains and back to the wood area.
The National Sami Council argues that Sweden is breaching conventions of land rights and human rights set up by both the United Nations and the European Council for regulating both the Sami's rights to use the land and maintaining their language and culture. But Maria Dahlgren also points out that reindeer herding is already a hampered business because of global warming. Nils Johannes Alas admits that he's seen these changes for 20 years. Rivers don't freeze over, as usual, blocking the migration since the animals can't cross running water. Unpredictable weather forces temperatures to go up and down, which often turns the snow into crust, so that the reindeer can't manage to get to their food. But Nils Johannes is adamant never to feed the reindeer himself. It's against his principles and the reindeer's natural instincts. But some other Sami villages do, at times even transport the reindeer on trucks. And recent surveys indicate that the calves are getting smaller and smaller due to global warming.
The green transition is important for everybody, of course, but there has to be a certain fairness in all of this. We have to have a fairness.
The concept of fairness comes back when Sanna Poruma talks about her main task these days, to coordinate the colossal forced move of her town Kiruna, a drama which started 25 years ago when the city literally began to crack. Kiruna town sits on a hill between two mountains of iron ore. But open-air pit mining ended a long time ago. Instead, citizens got used to a nightly rumble from detonations deep underneath the ground. And with 12 long trains of iron ore struggling every day over the snow-capped mountains to the Norwegian port of Narvik, the mine kept growing. It's now 1,600 meters deep, with 500 miles of roads inside. But as mining galleries were becoming longer and longer, water pipes, sewage, houses, even streets started to crack and break. The constant expansion of underground mining was taking its toll. It was threatening to swallow the city, which, as a result, ended in a dramatic joint decision by Elke Abi Mine and the Kiruna community. If we're going to continue mining and thereby keep our Kiruna alive, big parts of town must move and a new city centre rebuilt. And so it was. The first official Kiruna move attracted worldwide attention. not least when some 40 culturally significant houses were moved in one piece on gigantic trucks through the old to the new Kiruna, a spectacular sight. But most of the buildings were torn down. Over the last decade, a new town hall, schools, hotels, sports grounds have been constructed on the open fields a few miles away from the old city. 6,000 inhabitants, one-third of the town, have settled into new homes, safe from the advancing mine. Where did it all go? I asked Sanna Poruma.
In the beginning, people in Kiruna could come with their wishes. What do you want for Kiruna? How do you want the new city to look like? We have succeeded with the new Kiruna Centrum. It's really good and it's like people wanted it to be. And we have a great new school in the center. So not everything has been bad.
Linus Niva agrees. He's the head of LKAB's big department for urban transition.
Well, so far I would say the progress has been better than expected. We have established a new town centre and built a couple of thousand new homes.
The urban transition culminated with a spectacular move of the iconic red wooden Kiruna Church to its new home. When the church was built in 1912, the intention was to create a community hall, a meeting place for everyone. There's only one Christian symbol, a simple cross, inside the building, built in Sami style. And the altarpiece displays a spiritual landscape, not a biblical scene. The church has always been a venue for all kinds of religious and social activities. So in spite of the enormous technical challenge, and a bill of $80 million, it was essential for LKAB to take full responsibility for saving the church, often labelled as the soul of Kiruna and once voted the most beautiful building in Sweden. So the whole world could watch a live broadcast during 2 days in August, when 672 tons of church were taking off on 224 wheels, which could all turn the 40-meter-wide building 180 degrees, rolling slowly, slowly, but steadily, downhill among the jubilant crowds from near and afar. The band played, the people cheered, the Swedish king praised the city, the vicar praised the Lord, and a friend of mine from Africa asking if the whole thing was AI-generated. Well, you may well wonder, as seemingly only one man with a small joystick was guiding the whole church operation. It was surreal. But remaining on the old site is one grave of LKAB's and Kiruna's founder, Hjalmar Lundbom, still esteemed for his devotion to creating a socially viable town, not just a workers' settlement. But there are also 3,000 urns in a columbarium and ashes from 2,000 persons laid to rest in a memorial grove. How to move that? Another transport challenge to be solved. A week later, after the church move, the old bell tower, 32 meters high, was placed next to the church. However, this event was strongly overshadowed by a surprise press conference by LKAB Mine, delivering an explosive message. New surveys had concluded that the expanding mine was affecting the old Kiruna city much more than expected. So, another 2,700 buildings and another 6,000 people would have to go in yet another city move. Were you prepared for this? I asked Sanna Poruma.
No, I think it was a shock for everybody. We had in Kiruna commune planned for different scenarios. When LKAB went and told us about 6,000 more people, we were in shock. Everybody in Kiruna were in shock because we couldn't even imagine it to be that big. Moving of the shirts is the least we can expect of LKAB when they are moving our town and affecting everything in our town. Not only buildings, it affects everything. Healthcare, schools, everything. So when they had this party around the church, everybody was really happy. And it was a really good and fun time. And 1 week later, everybody was, why didn't they tell us before?
Yes, why didn't they tell you before?
My personal opinion is that they wanted to have a party for the people so it wouldn't be so hard on them when they came out with the news.
No, we didn't know many years in advance. It's a fairly complex question.
Says Linus Niva, LKAB director for the urban transition.
Well, a couple of years ago, we had some unexpected ground movement in the central parts of Kiruna, and we've been investigating that for the past few years. And our conclusions and our new forecast for ground movement shows us that we're affecting a larger area than first anticipated.
So once again, many Kiruna inhabitants are stressed, worried and sad. There's a lot of nostalgia when watching your neighbourhood disappear and personal anxiety about moving. Maybe having to face increased rents, take your kids to another school, or settle into a new old people's home, or close your shop and relocate your business. However, at the end of the day, there seems to be a consensus that there is no other alternative. I hear people saying that they have to differentiate between what they feel from what they know is inevitable in order for Kiruna to survive. The iron ore mine and the people of Kiruna remain in symbiosis.
You only need to take a look at the map. There's only Kiruna here. We're alone, and there's a reason. It's a good reason for that. Kiruna as a town and the mine grew up together, and we will stand together. Right now, we've been in Kiruna for 130 years, and that's not the usual case for mines, which means that our footprint is really, really small compared to what we deliver to the world.
Although the mine is gigantic, LKAB argues that the impact on nature and people is small, also because all valuable treasures are in one place. The new gigantic body of iron ore, together with a sensational amount of rare earth metals, plus a rich deposit of phosphorus, a key nutrient in fertilizers for food, which is also a critical mineral in Europe. Linus Niva emphasizes that this unique combination is a geopolitical necessity.
And it is mineable in Sweden. We have responsibility to the rest of the world and to Europe and to ourselves to mine those resources.
That's true, because Kiruna is not about Kiruna in itself. The move of Kiruna is really important from a perspective of independence for Sweden and Europe.
Robert Illitalo is director of a new economic association called Kiruna Växer, which literally means Kiruna is growing, bringing together all possible entities within a community, from business to culture, and with the goal of making Kiruna, quote, stand tall and become the most attractive of municipalities to live and work in.
When we got the message, and of course it's a sorrow of what will happen, should we move our house, is that possible? You went through all these emotions in a time of grief. But now my family's house will be built in within 1 year and we will move. So now we're looking forward to this.
Everyone is in this together?
Exactly. Everyone is in it together. When you ask people from Kiruna, they always answer, okay, no problem. So they call it the no problem people. They actually printed T-shirts. But if you go back to Kiruna's history, it's a very young city. The area is really old. People have been living here since the Ice Age, but the city in itself started 135 years ago. A couple of engineers came here and they say that, whoa, you have a massive amount of iron ore. How can we excavate this? Well, we need infrastructure. We need railroads. We need roads because there were no railroads. There were no roads. The only way to come to Kiruna was by winter or basically going up streams in the big rivers. Basically, what we're into right now is that's a recipe that they did to build Kiruna. And we have to repeat that recipe because the town is disappearing. We have to rethink what is the model of the new city.
Yes, we have to start again. And also, in my point of view, there's a lot of cultural heritage buildings in these areas.
Clara Nyström is the municipality antiquarian. That means she has a key role in preserving the town's history and culture. When I met her 5 years ago, she was convinced that the technical problems of moving the city of Kiruna would be solved since the engineering expertise was fantastic. But she worried about the psychological challenge, how to preserve history, memories, identity and feelings. But now she's basically pleased with the results, notably with the church.
It's really important that we work so hard with the new location, the surrounding of the church. It was not just the church, and also more buildings around the church to try to create something that people can feel similarities with old Kiruna. It's really important to have this mix. It's nothing just new, it's also the old part.
It's both good and bad. We do like the new Centrum. Everything is connected. In the old town, you had the nice Kiruna views. Down here, it's a completely different feeling.
22-year-old Rasmus Göransson sells everything you can possibly need for a rich outdoor life in one of the many elegant new shops in the new city centre, which is a proper centre, with coffee shops and other venues, a real meeting place, unlike the old scattered city. Rasmus recently settled into his first home, and now he has to move again.
I bought a new apartment, and then just a month and a half after, we got the decision that part of the town was also going to be broken down. It's my first apartment that I've bought, so it's sad, but I don't have too hard feelings about it. You have to look on the positive side. You can't always be sad about the old things changing.
Do you feel you have a future here?
Yeah, absolutely.
But Clara Nyström admits to one disappointment, the lack of colours in the new city.
The colour is very important for the history of Kiruna. We have like yellow, green and red buildings. But I feel that the architect, they look at the environment and the history and try to create something. But they feel that, okay, the identity, it's the mine, it's the mountain. So we make it white as the snow and also black as the iron ore. Oh. And I think that is something different than architecture did in the 50s and 1900. They looked at the environment and saw that, okay, it's so white in Kiruna, it's snow, the mountains are gray, we have to have color to make a contrast. Mm-hmm. So now we are really trying to steer more.
Meaning guide and control the architects and the builders to a greater extent. And the deputy mayor admits to another mistake.
We don't have the parks yet because we were so focused on moving buildings and making roads and infrastructure. So in the process, we forgot the softer things in life like parks and trees. So that has been a disappointment.
It's happening now, and a lot of people ask, where is the parks, where is the greenness, where are the trees? Because old Kiruna was very green. So we have a city park that is now under construction. Next time, we should build the park first. So hopefully it will be green next year.
I would say there's been thousands of things that we didn't think of from the start. Of course, we've been doing this for roughly 15, 20 years, so we learned a lot of things, so we're better off now.
As Linus Niva also said, one only has to look at the map to understand the Arctic. Stockholm, the capital, is a part of Central Europe, as close to Brussels and Berlin as it is to Kiruna. Living conditions up here are very special. The entire municipality is as big as half of the Netherlands, including also the Talga mine in Vittangi. The total population of 23,000 has in theory almost 1 square kilometer each to live on. Yet accommodation is scarce. Sanna Inga Poroma.
We have many fly-in, fly-out people who come here and work 1 week and go to their home commune or they go to their home countries. They work like 3 months And then they come back and work 3 months. So we have people from all around the world. All the people that come here to work, that fly in, fly out, we want them to stay here and bring their families, but we don't have any room for them. We don't have any housing for them. So that's a problem. And I have met a lot of people who come here and work, and they say, oh, I want to bring my family. I want to live here. It's so nice, but I can't find a house. I can't find an apartment. So it's really tough in Kiruna.
Despite all the wealth LKAB is bringing to the nation, Kiruna struggles with its economy and to maintain all communal service. The burden to handle the transition is taking its toll.
We have a problem with people that are working in healthcare. They choose the industry, the mine, instead of working in the healthcare or in the schools because of the high salaries. More mining in Kiruna is draining the healthcare, the schools, everything around.
The big hospital bears witness of the ongoing drama. Patients can hear the nightly detonations in the mine. There are more and more cracks and doors hard to close in the building. LKAB technicians are constantly monitoring what's happening, not least to make sure floors remain level so patient beds don't start rolling around on their own. The building will supposedly function until 2031, but by then a new hospital must be ready. Then it's the money. Who will pay for all these unexpected new costs? The municipality claims that LKAB should pay much more for the transition, but LKAB, the state-owned company, refers that matter to the state, the Swedish government. Linus Niva.
We will construct and see to that there's new homes. Everything that we have to move or tear down, we will build new facilities for it. But we can't do that without the land to build new buildings.
LKAB has allocated another $3.6 billion until 2035 for phase two of the urban transition. But all the land needed is state-owned. LKAB and the municipality has jointly put a strong demand on the Swedish government to assist. So far, no response. Politicians from left to right are saying that the government has let them down. Some even call it neocolonialism. But at the same time, all involved believe that in the end, the government has no choice but to sort out the financing. Robert Ilitalo from Kiruna is growing.
What's happening in Kiruna is unprecedented, I would say, in most parts of the world, moving a city. So laws are not made for moving a city. So that's where the state has to come in. And then, of course, the EU has to go in, because what's happening in Kiruna is important for EU's independence. So how can they support this? And if you look at, for example, the mining communities, coal mining communities in Czechoslovakia, Poland, Germany, they have transformation funds where they can actually adapt. When they do this green transformation from a coal perspective, they get funds from EU. And the same kind of funds, of course, should exist here. On top of all this, the need for rare earth minerals, the need for iron ore, the need for phosphates, the need for satellites traveling up to space is too important for the EU and for Sweden to neglect.
Satellites. That is about S-Range, 40 minutes drive east of town, Europe's only space center able to launch satellites. So, since Kiruna plays such a vital role in Europe, LKAB and the Kiruna City Hall believe that mining should be secured for at least another 130 years. Talga's perspective is shorter. Its concession is for 25 years with the option to prolong the process, providing jobs for some 250 persons. The intention is to eventually go underground, but since the Vittangi mine is nearly four times richer in graphite than most other global findings, it will only take two trucks a day driving down from the forest to Luleå in order to furnish 200,000 electric cars annually. And now, thanks to a Swedish research grant and the Talga Test Laboratory in Luleå, the Talga factory has another pioneering capacity, how to recycle graphite.
Well, the recycling's been a recent development for us. So not only can our technology, which is processing the natural graphites that are in the mine material, we can also use that same technology now to receive from the recyclers who have already removed the majority of the metals. So the metals that are in batteries have been extracted by them. There's a lot of value in that. And they've come to us and said, is this material, which is the leftover anode and there's other carbon materials, is it worth anything? It's confirmed that we can, in fact, remove all of the impurities that have been built up in the battery as a result of charging and discharging. We can put that back into our coating plant and create anode again and create a fully circular battery industry where there's a recycling component. So adding capacity to our Luleå refinery, maybe up to around 5,000 tonnes. So when you think about the amount of capital and infrastructure built around new mines and developing mines, and as well as that, the amount of financing needed for that as well. So I think recycling makes economic sense.
Martin Phillips has already spent 2 years in Sweden, working in a building from 1680. From its beautiful views of the water surrounding the island called Old Town in Stockholm, he elaborates on two lessons learned.
One good thing about Europe, I'm an Australian working over here, it's the quality of the R&D people here, the innovation.
R&D, research and development, includes in Luleå a technical university, a pilot factory to produce fossil-free steel, and LKAB extracting rare earth metals from its mine waste. And there's more in England.
We've got an R&D centre in Cambridge with a number of PhDs working full-time there on our products. We've got a pilot plant in northern Sweden, in Luleå, that's running and testing all of our anode materials. So these sorts of innovations, I think we can export or take into Australia.
A second reoccurring issue is Talga's relationship with the local Sami.
Yeah, no, we respect as well the need to keep and maintain their culture. I'd also add a few things. One is when we do think about Talga is part of a larger cumulative effect over many years and huge mines, wind farms, the S range. These are all parts of really how the Sami think about all of their pastoral lands and migration pathways. And when we talk to them, I think it's been clear to me that that cumulative effect is really what they're concerned about. And obviously it keeps going and more mines get approved. We've tried to minimise our impacts the best that we can. I can't speak on behalf of all the other effects, but I do feel that we are included in amongst them. But we certainly have a very small mine and we have, I think, a very strong case for learning how we can coexist together. And we're there for a certain period of time and we have a closure plan. And our job, when we do leave, is to leave it in the state where we can hand it back and it's better than it was before.
However, Nils Johannes Allas is far from convinced.
We have no other place to be. This is our home, our ranger's home, our next generation's home. Our hunting and fishing traditions are gone. And it's not just the ranger, it's a whole culture. I want to show my culture to children. And when I see children, when the youth, when they hear about the mines and other exploration, they cry in the nights when they hear about someone going to take away our land.
What will you do?
I don't know what I'm going to do. I have to believe it's not going to be a mine.
When Nils Johannes describes his love of the wilderness and working with his reindeer, the Vittangi Sami chairman also brings up a totally different threat, which I had never heard of here, although being born a Swede, the new fashion of heli-skiing. In spring, wealthy tourists are dropped by helicopters high up in the mountains in order to slide down on perfectly untouched snow, as well as when tourists take snow scooters out in nature. The noise scares the reindeer away and may result in newly born calves being abandoned. The deputy mayor again.
We have a lot of foreign companies that come here because in Sweden we don't have a law or a restriction about the mountains. And this is also a thing that the government, the state has to control. We from the commune, we have tried many times to say no, but we can't. So the state has to come and say, you can't fly helicopters here because of the reindeers. But also the people who come to the mountains to ski, see the nature, live in the quiet environment. So the local tourist companies, they also say this is a problem.
Yes, last year Kiruna registered 670,000 visitors. Robert Ilitalo again.
One part is, of course, leisure. People come here because it's getting very hot in certain places. So some visitors call it coolocation. They come here because it's a bit cooler. You have the northern lights, you have beautiful nature, you have the midnight sun. But then you have another category that comes here to actually see a town that's moving. Because when you come here now, you won't be able to visit the same place in 5 years.
Changes are indeed eye-catching with the new skyline and modern architecture. But everyone I met says the old pioneering spirit in Kiruna is alive and kicking. Sanna Poruma.
Everybody who lives here loves Kiruna and wants the best for Kiruna, of course. Yes, because I believe in Kiruna and I love to live here. And I believe that we can do this move, we can make it work.
Finally, if Kiruna succeeds, scientists believe the town could be an inspiration for other parts of our planet, which are facing big problems like rising oceans, reoccurring hurricanes, devastation of agricultural land, overpopulation, overexploitation of our common resources, all jeopardizing human conditions and habitats. More places on Earth are likely to have to learn from this remote corner of the world, Kiruna.
Kiruna, how a remote land and a sinking city can become an inspiration for a troubled world. How Sweden can help Australia make do. Thanks to presenter Anne Holmes and to Finn Norgren, producing. So Belle, a lesson for other regions around the world who also may be affected by loss of home territory?
I guess so, but these are very special circumstances. And Kiruna had the financial backing to do all this. It was bankrolled by the mining company. But some towns simply dwindle and fade away when mining companies move in nearby. And we can see that in the town of Wollar in central New South Wales. An open-cut coal mine opened 20 years ago, a few kilometres from the town. And the company that owns the mine bought pretty much all of the houses. The population has dropped from around 300 to 52. And Wollar residents fear for the town's future. So Kiruna is a very, very special situation.
One of the keys is they asked the population what they wanted, and they've been asking them for some time and responding. Thank you, Belle Smith, and production by David Fisher. Next week, the Science Show goes to Perth to plant trees and save cities in other ways. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Before we go, a quick note about changes to the Science Show and other science offerings on ABC Radio National in 2026. The full Science Show can be heard on Saturdays at noon, with a repeat at 4 a.m. on Monday. But this year, a shorter version of the Science Show will also be broadcast on Mondays at 1:30 p.m. It's part of Radio National's Daily Dose of Science, where every weekday at that time, 1:30 p.m, you'll find an ABC science program on the airwaves. So scratch your science itch with the Science Show on Monday, the wild and wonderful What the Duck on Tuesday, deep storytelling with Science Friction on Wednesday, the always illuminating All in the Mind every Thursday, and to cap off the working week, Health and Science Made Simple on What's That Rash and Lab Notes each Friday at 1:30 p.m. And, of course, you can find full episodes of The Science Show on the ABC Listen app. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.